Truth was not so flattering. I had been manipulated. Oscar Wilde is credited with the quote, "Everything in the world is about sex except sex. Sex is about power." Stafford had just reminded me of a woman's true purpose, and it wasn't writing jokes. He had gotten what he wanted, or maybe even what he thought he deserved. The same tribute he suggested I offer Atkins. When Stafford started kissing me, I worried that if I rejected him, he'd retaliate by not hiring me. Later, it struck me that the reverse outcome was just as undesirable. If Stafford hadn't taken me seriously as a writer before, this would not make things better. And if I did return to the room, would I feel like I'd gotten the job for abilities other than my writing? Would more be expected? I never had the chance to find out. I was back in New York City when Gavin called with a sad agent. Hello. Stafford wasn't bringing me back on staff. I imagine he never intended to. After I hung up the phone, I replayed the beats in my head. I feared that Stafford would penalize me, so I submitted to him, and he still penalized me. In a way, it was funny. This joke provided a classic shift in perception, which reveals a surprising motivation. I saw myself as a determined, hard-working writer, and Stafford saw me as a way to get off. And that's when it hit me. I really don't like spiders and snakes. Stafford and I never spoke or crossed paths again. It's unlikely we will, since I don't get to Branson, Missouri much. If we did meet, I don't know what I'd say to him. But I know what I'd tell my younger self. Don't mistake sexual power for real power. If you think gratifying a colleague or boss will help your career, think again. Gloria Steinem put it perfectly. If women could sleep their way to the top, there would be a lot more women at the top. There's a tendency for women who wind up in these situations to beat themselves up and declare, "I was such an idiot," or "God, how could I have been so stupid?" I'm glad I never did that. I don't believe I acted stupidly. Vulnerable and in shock, I'd made a decision out of fear and confusion. I never considered any recourse, in part because I wanted to move on. Besides, what recourse did I have? If the show or network had a human resources department, I wasn't aware of it. There were no handbooks on company policy or sensitivity workshops to enlighten employees. It would be 3 more years until Anita Hill testified against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Like so many, I hung on every word of Hill's courageous testimony. I watched a hero rise in real time. 25 years later, Hollywood still has a long way to go in changing its casual acceptance of behavior that ranges from inappropriate to criminal. In fact, sexual harassment is so embedded in show business, the industry even has a cutesy name for it. The casting couch. Which does sound a lot nicer than the rape sofa. Predatory behavior often becomes an open secret. Back in the 90s, female assistants at William Morris would warn one another not to get into an elevator with client Bill Cosby. In 2005, Courtney Love was asked to give advice to any young girls planning on moving to Hollywood. She bravely responded, "If Harvey Weinstein invites you to a private party in the Four Seasons, don't go." So many co-workers, agents, lawyers, and managers looked the other way while the assaults continued. And so many of these same people have behaved inappropriately themselves. I worry that Weinstein actually raises the bar on bad behavior. As long as a producer doesn't walk into a hotel room naked, clutching a tiny bottle of lotion, he can now consider himself a gentleman. I understand there's no greater love in this world than that of an executive producer for a vulnerable intern, assistant, or actress. But if you're a powerful man, control your impulses. Ruling out sex with employees and professional contacts leaves 3 billion possible partners, minus maybe 200. And of course, you can reverse the genders and the same holds true. Heading into the second season, Stafford also jettisoned Mason and one other writer. New writers were added to replace us, all male. The penis party was in full swing. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour lasted for 10 more episodes before getting canceled. Since then, I've stayed in touch with Tom, who ended up marrying Marcy. A twist! Marcy remains one of my closest friends. She and Tom have two great kids, and our families have spent many happy days at their vineyard together. I still look back on my time at the show fondly, and the good far outweighs the bad. Tom and Mason were patient mentors. I watched world-class musicians perform up close. And I got to work with a hero of mine. Martin Mull wasn't the biggest name to appear on the show, but he was the one I was most excited about. At 16, I was obsessed with Fernwood Tonight, a short-lived Norman Lear series that starred Martin as Barth Gimble, a smarmy, leisure-suit-wearing host of a cheesy talk show. Fred Willard played his guffawing sidekick. Fernwood was my introduction to anti-humor. The show fascinated me in part because I didn't always get the jokes. Like when Barth deadpanned lines like, "For those of us who saw the tragedy of Vietnam firsthand on TV," all the writers gathered when Martin came in to pitch us a possible cold open. He ran through the setup and some dialogue and then hit us with the punchline. "It's time to lay to rest this entire brothers business. They are not brothers. It has all been a big lie. Join me then, won't you, in accepting and enjoying Mr. Dick Smothers and his lovely wife, Tommy." Tom roared. He sent Martin off to an empty office to fill out the monologue. Martin was halfway out the door when Tom suddenly had a thought. "Nell," he said, "why don't you go help him?" Like a puppy, I leapt from my chair and scampered after Martin. He sat at a desk and I sat across, smiling as I watched him massage the beats. Occasionally, Martin would ask me about a word choice and I'd offer an opinion. Mostly, I listened and nodded and laughed. About 20 years later, it hit me. Martin Mull didn't need my help. Tom just wanted to give me the chance to observe a genius hone a bit. Now that's a nice twist. Chapter 5. The Payoff. From Newhart episode, Get Dick. Writer's first draft, 1989. Interior, Vermont, in day. Larry. "Then it hit him like a ton of sticks." Dick. "You mean bricks." Larry. "A ton of anything is still a ton, Dick." A professional comedy writer's job is to make others laugh. Sometimes we write jokes and think, "Yes, that will work." And sometimes we write jokes that crack ourselves up. When the sticks bricks joke first popped into my head, it made me laugh. Rereading it 28 years later, it still does. By June 1989, I had no idea where my TV career stood. In 12 months, I'd been hired on 3 different series, which seemed like a positive sign. But then none of those jobs had lasted longer than 3 months, which seemed like a negative sign. For all the encouragement I'd received, there'd been equal disappointment. To put it in dating terms, the guy seemed really into me, but I suspected he might be gay. Still, I wanted to make this new career work. Writing for TV made way more sense than writing for magazines. And by sense, I mean money. After months of being 20 years younger than my Smothers Brothers colleagues, it was great to be back in New York City and reunite with friends my own age. Most Fridays I attended movie night, which was founded by magician Penn Jillette and some friends. We'd all gather at the Howard Johnson's in Times Square for Brownie Sundays before heading to a midnight movie. Movie night rules include sitting in the front row and applauding whenever the name of the movie is mentioned. Any establishing skyline shot triggers a chorus of,
Chicago.
Even if the Eiffel Tower or the Washington Monument appears in the shot, you still shout, Chicago. I first met Penn and his partner Teller on assignment for Rolling Stone magazine to cover the release of their movie, Penn and Teller Get Killed. The interview took place at their office in a sketchy Times Square apartment building. After I asked all my questions, Penn offered to walk me to the elevator and see me out safely. If the elevator had come right away, my life would have been very different. Instead, we waited and waited and ran out of small talk. I became self-conscious of the differential between Penn's physical presence and my own. At 6'6 and 220 pounds, he was a foot and a half taller and double my weight. You know, I blurted out, if a volcano erupted right now and covered us in lava, archaeologists would dig up our bones in a million years and assume I was your lunch. Penn let his jaw drop theatrically. He stared at me for a beat. Do you want to go see Run DMC at the Nassau Coliseum this weekend? A bunch of us are going, and I've got an extra ticket. And that's how I joined Penn's merry band of misfits. Penn's friends were a mix of magicians, artists, computer scientists, and comedy writers. We came from different fields, but all had certain things in common. We were all teetotaling, science-loving, sex-positive atheists. I started spending what Penn would call stupid amounts of time with him and his friends. Nothing made me happier than a voicemail in Penn's unmistakable low growl. Eddie and I are getting dinner. You coming? Penn was a flawlessly generous friend and included me in all the activities. When the group decided to see a live sex show, Penn invited me to join. I had no idea what to expect walking into the seedy show world, the last of the Times Square peep shows. We passed rows of near-naked women in stalls, and I noted the place reeked of bleach. That's not bleach, Penn informed me. That's the base smell of cum. People think these places clean with bleach. They don't. In the main showroom, a crowd of men stood in a circle watching two women who were really enjoying each other's company. The next act was a solo artist who began by slipping a condom on a dildo.
I hope she's wearing a diaphragm in case the condom breaks, I whispered to Penn.
When the next act started, I told Penn that I was taking off. He nodded, and someone else from the group, who'd also seen enough, walked me out. I appreciated my glimpse into this alien subculture, and I loved that Penn let me join this stereotypically male excursion and never insinuated that my presence would ruin anyone else's fun. I didn't feel pressured to go or pressured to stay. Penn trusted people to make their own decisions. Penn also invited me on a weekend scouting mission to the desert when he and Teller started thinking about performing in Vegas. The duo had a successful run on Broadway and racked up dozens of memorable appearances on SNL. On Late Night with David Letterman, they famously released a top hat filled with cockroaches all over Dave's desk, sending the host flying out of his chair. It was a rare instance of Dave losing his cool on air. Moving to Vegas was a solid business decision for magicians. They're really the only people you can say that about. In April 1987, about 10 of us accompanied Penn to what he called a city built on bad math. The group included Billy West, the future voice of Fry on Futurama, and Spike Ferriston, who later wrote the Soup Nazi episode of Seinfeld. The group took in the classic Vegas Review Jubilee, where we learned that the Titanic sank not because it struck an iceberg, but because the captain was distracted by topless dancers. This would explain why the band kept playing as the ship sank. The girls had to dance to something. I laughed so much during that trip, and I'll always be grateful to Penn for helping me feel safe and funny after a rocky year. For work, I picked up magazine assignments and was accepted into the Disney New Writers Program, which paid me to write my first pilot. I mined my own experience and wrote Funny Girls, about a female writing team on a late-night talk show. Unlike Liz Lemon, My leads were low-level writers working for a vain host and a head writer whose character description read, "Head writer, sexist and overbearing, he makes life hell." Okay, so maybe I was still working out my issues with Stafford. Funny girls went nowhere. Next, I wrote a spec script for the Ellen Burstyn Show, which was the rare sitcom that shot in New York. Secretly, I was hoping for another quick sale like Shandling. My script found its way to the showrunner, who kindly took the time to mark it up, scribbling notes in the margins. The remarks were not positive. The word harsh pops up next to a lot of my jokes. One line even got a, "You don't know this, but you could never make a joke like this on TV." About three-quarters of the way through, the comments stopped. I flipped to the end to look for a final word of encouragement like, "Good effort," or "Keep trying." Nothing. Even though the showrunner had impressive credits and I was a novice, I remember thinking, he's wrong. Maybe my comedy wasn't too harsh. Maybe his comedy was too soft. Subjectivity works both ways. Just because you allow yourself to be judged doesn't mean you have to accept that judgment. In June, Gavin called to say the sitcom Newhart was looking for a couple of story editors, the lowest-level writers on staff. Bob Benditson, the supervising producer, had enjoyed my Shandling script and wanted to meet. Conveniently, he and his wife Heidi were on their way to Italy with a layover at JFK Airport. If I got myself to the gate, he could interview me for the job while waiting for his flight. This was exciting. I'd watched Bob Newhart's first series in the 70s, where the legendary comedian played a psychologist who remains calm even when surrounded by lunatics. Newhart is the master of small moments, snatching laughs in the pauses, in the unsaid, and in the stare. As someone once put it, Newhart blinks funny. As a teenager, I was captivated by the way Bob and his TV wife, Emily, played by Suzanne Plachette, interacted in their cool, modern marriage. She worked, he worked. She rolled her eyes when he expected dinner on the table. We even got to see them in their mid-century decorated bedroom with a sophisticated bookshelf behind the headboard. Then when I was in college, the Bob Newhart Show had a resurgence in syndication, spawning the first TV drinking game. Viewers had to down a shot every time a character said, "Hi, Bob." The second Newhart series, the one I was up for, was set in rustic Vermont where he played an innkeeper named Dick, who remains calm even when surrounded by lunatics. Created by Barry Kemp, the show had flashes of absurdity. Each week, three flannel-shirted, woodsy Vermont brothers would stride into Dick's inn. Only one spoke, and he routinely introduced his siblings. "This is my brother Daryl, and this is my other brother Daryl." By the final season, the audience would erupt into applause as soon as the Woodsy brothers entered. On the ride to the airport, I brainstormed topical jokes so I'd have something to say if the interview stalled. I was two for two at getting hired after meetings, and I remember feeling confident as Bob Benditson and I sat down at the gate. Bob remembers our meeting differently. "You were so freaked out," Bob told me in 2017. "I was trying to calm you down, but you just kept pitching jokes. I kept saying, 'We like your writing. You don't have to keep pitching.' You just kept trying to impress me." I do recall that after our meeting, I walked around the corner and kind of fell apart. But at least no one saw me. "You know, after you left, Heidi walked by you," Bob said. "She came back and said, 'That girl is hyperventilating.'" Despite my nervousness, Bob gave me a shot. Newhart had a 24-episode order, and I was guaranteed to write on the first 13. If the producers were pleased with my work, they had an option to pick me up for the back 11. Once again, I crossed the country. I took over the lease on Marcy's West Hollywood apartment and bought my first car, a dark blue Honda Civic. Newhart was shot at the MGM Studios in Studio City. Each morning I'd drive past the Roseanne stage and park across from the 30-something house. After lunch, the riders would sometimes stroll over to the northwestern corner, head down a sloping path, and arrive at the lagoon from Gilligan's Island. One of the main sets of a popular 60s sitcom, the lagoon was nothing but a dirty, busted-up, oversized tub. And that's showbiz. For the first time, I was part of a traditional sitcom writer's room. There were seven of us, two executive producers, supervising producer Bob Benditson, a mid-level male producer, and a team of two women who were story editors like me. The bosses were both named Mark, and we'd sit in Mark and Mark's office to break, that is, plot, stories. Right away, I figured out that if I pitched a joke or plot point that got shot down, I shouldn't dwell on the rejection. Some writers berate themselves internally. Why did I say that? I shouldn't have pitched it. But if everyone else in the room is working on their next pitch, then fixating on the previous one puts you a step behind. This approach also applies to an overall career where it's better to focus on the next opportunity rather than ruminate on missed chances and setbacks. I also learned not to waste time with wind-ups. There's a tendency, especially with women, to kick off pitches with caveats like, "I don't quite have it, but I was thinking that it might be funny if maybe he said something like," and these may not be the exact words, but the gist is, by then, who's listening? I tend to blurt out my jokes as quickly as possible. If they fly, great. If they thud, I don't take it personally. Again, Bob remembers it differently. Every time Mark and Mark didn't like what you did, you'd look a little destroyed, Bob recalls. I thought you were very insecure. Of course I was insecure. And don't forget the part about being petrified, too. I felt massive pressure to succeed. After so many false starts, I needed to last a full season and not get cut after 13 episodes. My first script assignment had a silly plot that involved Dick accidentally burning down his favorite French restaurant after sneaking a cigar in the men's room. Feeling guilty, Dick invites the chef to stay at the inn. Monsieur Hubert is grateful until he discovers that Dick caused the fire and vows revenge. The episode was filled with jokes about poisoned omelets and Dick being mowed down by wheels of brie. It needed a name, and we landed on Get Dick. So yes, my first script had a penis joke for its title. I had a week to finish my first writer's draft, and I spent most of that time scribbling in Dupar's coffee shop near the studio. Jack Kerouac fueled his work with Benzedrine. Truman Capote relied on gin. My drug of choice was a large fudge brownie topped with an inch of thick chocolate frosting. I estimate it takes 100 calories for me to generate each page of a script. Give me a deadline and lots of carbs, and I'll get the job done. The character voices on Newhart were well established, and I quickly discovered that sitcom writing was more satisfying to me than sketch writing. I turned in my draft late one afternoon, handing it directly to one of the Marks. He held it to his nose. "Smells funny," he said. I smiled, but my stomach lurched. The nights after handing in a script are long and filled with anxiety. There's a common fantasy about turning in a draft so brilliant that the boss calls you at home that night to let you know. That fantasy has only come true for me once, and it wasn't that night. The next morning, I got into my office early and left my door open in case an executive producer wanted to stop by and flash a thumbs up. Bob Benditson was the first to appear. "Hey, Nell," he said in a sing-songy pitch. "Great job. Really funny script." "Seriously? What, you don't believe me? Have you read it?" I smiled. Bob praised a few specific jokes, including Larry pointing out to Dick that a ton of sticks weighs the same as a ton of bricks. He had some notes, but we'd go over those later. Bob headed to his office in the building next door. A half hour later, Bob returned to my office looking rattled. He fumbled, trying to find the right words, but there were no right words. Mark and Mark had not shared his enthusiasm for my draft. More precisely, they hated it. "I have their notes," Bob said, "and there are a lot of them." Bob pulled up a chair next to me behind my desk. We opened our scripts. "The first big note is that they didn't think you had enough jokes." Pathetically, I fished for a shred of positive feedback. "Did they like the sticks and bricks joke?" I asked in a small voice. "No," he said bluntly. "They thought it required too much setup. Here's what you need to do." Bob went down the first page, pointing at every line of dialogue and saying, "Joke, joke, 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 joke." We walked through each page. Bob was professional and precise and made it as painless as rectal surgery can be. I saved the marked-up draft. Pretty much every page has half the dialogue X'd out, and the dialogue that remains is noted. One page amuses me because after giving specific criticism like wordy and too jokey, Bob clearly just gave up and delivered the global note, "All better." To this day, when I'm editing my scripts, I'll write DB in the margin next to a joke. It's my shorthand for do better. My friend Rob Bragan has the best description for how writers should accept notes. He graduated from Berkeley and adopts the advice of protesters being dragged off by the police. "Go limp," he advises. "Don't stiffen up and don't fight." I took the Mark's notes with minimal defensiveness. Two things helped sustain me. First, it was kind of cool to be getting notes on a sitcom script. I hadn't gotten that far on It's Gary Shandling's Show, so in a way, this was progress. And second, I was so grateful that Bob had stopped by my office that morning with praise. It was a perfect reminder that one person's great job is another person's page one rewrite. The bones of the script didn't change, although most of the dialogue did. My second draft was better received. The room did a pass, and the episode went into production. Newhart's shooting schedule began with a Monday morning full-cast table read. Table read is a highly technical term referring to the way actors sit around a table and read a script. The read gives the writers a sense of whether the plot works, the jokes work, and the pacing works. More importantly, it gives writers free bagels. At Newhart, the cast, the director, the network, and studio execs, and the writer-producers sat at tables pushed together on the stage. An additional row of chairs for crew members, agents, and assistants ringed the perimeter. On the morning of the Get Dick table read, I walked onto the stage, grabbed a bagel and a freshly printed script, then beelined to the chairs on the periphery and sat down. My name was on the script, but I wanted to be as unobtrusive as possible. I was too scared to sit at the center table. I was also too scared to introduce myself to Bob Newhart. No one else bothered to introduce us either. The table read went smoothly. For all the Mark's focus on joke, 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 the biggest laugh in the script came after Newhart delivered these three words. "I feel bad." The line doesn't look like a joke on the page, but it was tailored for Newhart's deadpan delivery and stopped the table read as we all gasped for breath. A skilled comedic actor will give the impression that he's pulling laughs out of thin air, but he's working off a deep understanding of human nature. That's the advantage of writing for a Bob Newhart, and especially the Bob Newhart. After the read, the producers huddle with the network for notes. If the actors have any problems, they ideally express them at this point. The writers head back to the office to start the rewrite while the director starts blocking scenes. There are run-throughs on Tuesday and Wednesday, prompting additional adjustments. Thursday is camera blocking day, and Friday is shoot night. Newhart used to warm up the crowd with one of his telephone stand-up routines. My favorite was the Englishman listening to Sir Walter Raleigh calling from Virginia to pitch him on the wonders of smoking tobacco. The listener responds warily, I think we're going to have a rather tough time selling people on sticking burning leaves in their mouths. Get Dick, still a penis joke, turned out well, and I was assigned another script. The other story editors were assigned a second script, too, but were handed a dog of a story. George, the handyman, meets a woman who he deems perfect except for one thing. She has a cartoonishly large ass, and he just can't get past it. Get it? The female story editors rightfully protested the plot and pitched less offensive possibilities. Mark and Mark dug in their heels. Bob Benditson went to the story editors and tried to broker a deal. I kept saying, just make the show about how shallow George is, he recalled. I told them, I get your point, but this is the stupid business and those two guys are in charge. The story editors softened the physical insults as much as they could before the episode shot. Tensions remained high as we approached the 13-episode mark when the producers had to let the staff know if our options were picked up. A week earlier, the male co-producer was informed that his job was secure. All three female story editors were kept waiting until the last day of contractual notification. Bob Benditson was dispatched to deliver the verdicts. He stopped first at the team's office. Mark and Mark swung the axe. Then he stopped by my office. My neck was spared. Yay! Or maybe, yay? I felt awful about the other story editors and wasn't looking forward to sitting in the room without them. I also suspected that Mark and Mark didn't want me there, but Bob Benditson had argued my case. 26 years later, I asked him point blank if my suspicions were correct. Yeah, he responded sheepishly. Mark and Mark hired a new team of male story editors for the remaining episodes. Once again, I was the only female writer in the room. Staying on staff meant I got to be part of the series' final episode, which TV Guide's Matt Rausch placed at number 1 on the top 10 best finales list. After a wacky episode where Dick sells the Vermont Inn to Japanese investors, he wakes up in bed and rouses the lump under the covers next to him. The lump rolls over, revealing he's not with the woman who played his wife on Newhart. Instead, he's with Suzanne Plachette, who played his wife on the Bob Newhart show. You won't believe the dream I just had, he tells her. The audience went nuts at the meta version of And Then I Woke Up. It's not often that you have 8 seasons to set up a punchline. Mark and Mark and Bob Benditson co-wrote the finale, which was nominated for an Emmy. I had one joke in that episode. During the opening scene at a town meeting, a local proudly states, "We made the flying squirrel the town bird." On the evening of the finale, about an hour before the audience arrived, I slipped onto our soundstage. The crew was at dinner, so I had the set to myself. I wanted to stand in the old Bob Newhart Show bedroom set that had been taken out of storage and reconstructed. It was the strangest feeling to be inside a room that I'd watched on TV as a kid. I ran a finger over the sophisticated bookshelf behind the headboard. I felt like Alice through the looking glass. For all the ups and downs, I had survived the season and now had a written-by credit on 5 TV episodes. I was part of Newhart history, although I still hadn't formally met the star. Countless times I'd stood on set, watching the legend rehearse, and if he happened to look in my direction, I'd avert my eyes. If I was at the craft services table and he approached to grab a handful of popcorn, I'd scoot away. He played the most mild-mannered characters on TV, and yet for some reason, I was terrified of him. After a few minutes in the bedroom set, I decided to head to dinner. I walked across the stage, opened the door, and was startled to find myself face-to-face with the show star. There was no avoiding him, nowhere to scoot. There was only one thing for me to say. "Hi, Bob." Amazingly, he responded, "Hi, Nell." He stepped inside, and the heavy stage door shut behind him. I paused outside, blinking my eyes to adjust to the light. Our entire exchange had consisted of 4 words, but it felt deeply meaningful. In the joke about the 4 stages of a career, the first stage asks the question, who is Nell Scovell? Now I had an answer. Nell Scovell was a TV writer who just played the high bob game, pro version.
Stage 2. Get me Nell Scovell. Chapter 6. The Simpsons. Fugumi. Interior, doctor's office. The doctor addresses Homer Simpson, who has just learned that he ate poisoned blowfish. Doctor, you have 24 hours to live, Mr. Simpson. Homer, 24 hours? Doctor, well, 22. I'm sorry I kept you waiting so long. One fish, two fish, blowfish, bluefish. First draft. Where were you on the night of Sunday, January 14th, 1990? I was alone in my West Hollywood apartment watching a cartoon on TV. Normally this would not be memorable, but as the credits began to roll, I did something I'd never done before and have never done again. I called my agent at home. Gavin? It's Nell. Your client. I want to write for The Simpsons. Now a cultural institution? The Simpsons was not universally embraced when it debuted. Many dismissed the Yellow family as garish and too mean, which was exactly why I liked them. In an early episode, There's No Disgrace Like Home, the Simpsons try family counseling and are handed foam bats to hit each other with and work out anger issues. After a few swings, Homer asks, "Wouldn't these bats work better if we took the foam off?" The counseling session ends with all 5 members of the family sitting in chairs that allow them to give each other electric shocks. The shocks go on and on until in the background, the city lights dim. The characters, drawn by cartoonist Matt Groening, first appeared as interstitials on The Tracy Ullman Show. Sam Simon and James L. Jim Brooks helped develop and expand the shorts. Fox had only been in existence for a few years, so when Jim pitched the series, he had personally launched more hit comedies than the entire network. Months earlier, I'd interviewed with Jim's production company for a job on Tracy Ullman. The meeting went great, or so I thought. They didn't offer me a job. But when my agent pitched me to write a freelance episode for The Simpsons, they remembered my name. Al Jean and Mike Reese, who'd helped me at Shandling, worked on the show and vouched for me. Since not that many writers were clamoring to work on some weird-ass cartoon, The Simpsons offered me a script assignment. We set a date for me to come to the office and pitch story ideas. Where do you get your ideas is a question that baffles me. It's like asking, how do you grow your hair? The answer is basically the same. It just sort of happens. Things come out of your head. Developing an idea into a script can seem equally mysterious, but my coach boss, Barry Kemp, once boiled the complicated process down to 12 words. Writing, Barry said, is not an act of creation. It's an act of choice. An episode, article, or book doesn't flow out of a pen or keyboard fully formed. Each work is built concept by concept, beat by beat, word by word. It's a process of discovery. You head down a path which leads to another and another and another until you hit a dead end. Then you backtrack to where you made a wrong turn and look for a better way through. When I write, I feel like an optometrist, constantly flipping between lenses and asking, is this better? Is this? Slowly, the work comes into focus. Here's how choices, big and small, add up to an episode using my Simpsons as a case study. The story pitch. A story pitch sets up a situation, the sit in sitcom, and gives a sense of how the story might play out. It's what if, with a hint of what comes next. Most sitcom stories break down to 3 basic story beats. 1.
character has a problem. For example, Brad has two dates for the prom. 2. Character tries to solve the problem, but things get worse. Brad tries to keep both dates happy by running between the two until they bust him. 3. The problem gets resolved in a surprising way. The two dates fall in love. As they ditch Brad, he calls out, "Meg! Jenny! At least let me watch!" Canned laughter. The calm in sitcom. The Simpsons employs about 28 writers now, but when I walked into Sam Simon's office in the spring of 1990, there were fewer than 10. I recognized Al and Mike and was introduced to John Vitti, Wally Wolodarski, Jay Kogan, and George Meyer. Sam Simon sat behind a desk while the rest sunk into sofas. I sat on a chair rolled in from the outer office. The all-male room was welcoming but also intimidating. "So," Sam asked, "what have you got?" Many writers, especially those with backgrounds in stand-up, like to pitch off the cuff. I prefer to write my pitches down on a yellow pad and then read them as quickly as possible. It's less spontaneous, but there are two upsides. 1, reading means I don't have to make eye contact with anyone. And 2, 26 years later, I still know exactly what I pitched. I took a deep breath. It was the last one I took until I walked out of the room. Pitch number 1. Bart is at the free throw line. There's 1 second left in the citywide basketball game. Bart's team is behind by a single point. Bart makes a deal with God. If he helps Bart sink these 2 foul shots, Bart will never be mean to his sister Lisa again. Bart sinks the 2. His team wins. He's the hero. Bart arrives home exuberant and immediately asks Lisa if her face hurts. "No, why?" she replies. Bart starts the punchline. "Because it's k-" Then he remembers his vow. "It's kind of red on your cheeks. You might have a rash." Lisa rushes to the mirror to see. Bart notices a kick me sign on her back. He lines up, then remembers his vow. Lisa, noticing her shoelaces untied, bends over to tie it, and coupled with the sign, this is too much for Bart. He runs to Homer for advice. "If you make a deal with someone, do you have to keep your end of the bargain?"
"Yes," says Homer, "but only until the check clears."
"What if the deal is with God?" Bart asks.
"You got a problem there," says Homer. "Since God is all-seeing, it's hard to skip town."
Bart is depressed. What good is being a basketball hero if he can't tease his little sister? Life has no meaning as he realizes that tormenting her was his greatest pleasure. The episode ends at the state championships. With Bart's team down by a point and 1 second on the clock, Bart is back on the free throw line.
"Come on, Bart, do it again," his teammates shout. Bart gets an idea. "God, let's say I throw an air ball and we'll call it even, okay?"
Bart tosses an air ball. The team turns on him. Bart whispers to God,
"One more to forget the whole incident."
Bart throws another air ball. His team loses. Everyone hates Bart, who goes home happy and teases Lisa. Pitch number 2. It's Lisa's birthday, and she gets to choose the restaurant. She wants sushi. The family goes to Frank's Raw Fish Emporium. Bart orders a burger. Homer says,
"You don't go to a Japanese restaurant and order a burger."
To the waitress,
"I'll have the chicken platter."
Marge tries to get Homer to try the sea eel. He refuses.
"Well, how about a little blowfish? It's a delicacy."
He tries it. Just then, the sushi chef comes in yelling, "Do not eat the blowfish! It is a poisonous delicacy!" They all look at Homer. What do they do now? Chef says to get to a hospital immediately.
"In that case," says Marge, "we better get the check."
The restaurant says, "There's no charge
for the blowfish."
But the family will have to pay for the rest of the meal. The family feels bad for Homer, but worse for Lisa. After all, this has ruined her birthday. Emergency room at hospital has a very long line. Intern comes by to say they can't treat blowfish poisoning. Homer's down to his last 24 hours and has to figure out what to do before he dies.
"Try to have fun. It's Lisa's birthday." Phone rings. The restaurant made a terrible mistake. The bill should have been $36, not $42. They can pick up the $6 tomorrow. This gives Homer a reason to live. He decides to fight the poison, turns colors, retches, but manages to survive. Fans of the show know that Sam liked pitch number two. For the next hour, the room explored the comedic possibilities of Homer eating fugu and thinking he would die. Someone pitched that as soon as the waiter finds out that a customer has been poisoned, he should tell the chef, "Chef, you have disgraced us. Do the honorable thing." Then we cut to the chef taking an ornamental sword from the wall and raising it to commit harikiri. Someone else chimed in. Then the chef suddenly drops the sword and rushes off while the waiter shouts after him, "Hey, come back here! Do the honorable thing! Do the honorable thing!" My notes don't say who pitched this joke, but if I had to guess, I'd attribute it to George Meyer, who once told me that he thought the funniest thing in the world was a frustrated guy shaking his fist at the sky. I can picture the waiter doing that here. Deconstructing who contributed what to a script can get messy. Jokes are often joint efforts, and it's hard to say who deserves credit. The person who pitched the concept? Who honed the precise wording? Who added the additional kicker at the end? There's a story of a TV writer who, while on set, watched a line get a big laugh and then whispered to the person next to him, "I helped on the path to that joke." It sounds pathetic, but every TV writer has thought the same thing. Once the room landed on the general storyline, we moved on to what comes next. What if Homer says, "I guess I'll just lie down and die," someone pitched. But Marge has other plans.
"Homer, you have 24 hours. Do all the things you wanted to do. Let's go," Marge says.
Homer doesn't move. "I'm thinking," he says, channeling Jack Benny's famous response to "your money or your life." We laughed at the idea of keeping Homer on the couch for the entire episode, but that seemed one note. We jumped ahead and discussed what perspective Homer could gain from a near-death experience. Maybe he learns, "I'm a one-dimensional, shallow man," someone suggested. Or maybe he becomes determined to live life to the fullest, only to discover that he has no thoughts, no interests, and no desires, Sam said. His last 24 hours on Earth are about desperately trying to find meaning in his life, right before it ends. This suggestion led us down a path of Homer looking for a hobby. Someone pitched Homer going over to Ned Flanders' house. "I know Flanders is the neighbor," I interjected, "but I'm a little unclear on his character." It was so early in the series that Flanders had only appeared a few times. "Flanders is the all-American nice guy," someone explained. "Very encouraging. So, of course, Homer is bitter toward him." Sam threw out the idea that Homer recovers from the blowfish poisoning at the end of the first act and then joins a theater group that's putting on Tennessee Williams's A Streetcar Named Desire. We all laughed. Mike Reese suggested that Homer shows up to audition for the part of Stanley, and the director exclaims, "Normally, I don't like it when someone dresses in character, but you are a perfect slob." I'm not certain this was Mike's pitch, but it sure sounds like him. The third act would begin with Homer peering out from behind a curtain. "Ooh, a full house," he says. 25 people. At the after party, the cast gathers to read the review. In a twist, critics love the production, calling it a tidy hour and a half in the theater. Homer tears up. "And to think I almost didn't live to see this." Sam loved this idea, but something about it didn't appeal to me. Sam noticed my expression. "What?" Sam said. "You don't like the idea of Homer being in a play?" I really need to work on my poker face. "It's fun," I said. "But if it becomes an episode about community theater, then don't you miss out on the character exploration raised by the question, if Homer had only 24 hours to live, how would he spend it?" Sam tilted his head in a way that made me think I shouldn't have said anything. But the most important choice you can make for any episode is the story area. All other choices flow from that. Sam said he'd run both options by Jim Brooks and get his thoughts. Once he had a clear direction, they'd bring me back in to flesh out the story. A couple of days later, Sam called. "I guess you're the genius," he said. Jim liked your way better. Sam didn't abandon his funny Tennessee Williams notion. In the fourth season, a streetcar named Marge, written by Jeff Martin, featured Marge joining a community theater's production of the musical Oh, Streetcar. That episode makes every Best Simpsons list. So maybe I'm not such a genius after all. Breaking the story. With the broad strokes of a beginning, middle, and an end, the room can start to place the dots that later connect into a story. Writers often have different strengths. Some are better at plot, or jokes, or visual gags, or emotional moments. Using all the voices in a writer's room allows you to pool strengths. It's writing as a team sport. We mapped out a loose structure. Act 1 would focus on the family going out for sushi and end with Homer being poisoned. Someone pitched a doctor saying, "There's a test, but ironically it takes 24 hours to get the results. I still recommend you take it to protect me." Another pitch had the doctor asking, "Homer, how's your eyesight? You should donate your organs. Except your stomach." Act 2 would start with Homer making a list of things to do on his last day on Earth. We brainstormed possibilities based on Homer's existing relationships. Make peace with Dad, tell off boss, have a beer with the boys, listen to Lisa play her sax, teach Bart how to shave. Homer adds, be intimate with Marge. Although it's never mentioned in dialogue, number 11 on the list is plant a tree. I wrote that into the script as a nod to my grandmother Frances, who liked the quote, "In their life, everyone should plant a tree, write a book, and have a child." Like Homer, I'm putting off the tree planting until the last possible second. The easiest way to build a story is not to use your imagination, but to simply apply logic. Maggie is a baby, so logically, Homer would want to make a videotape for her to watch when she's older. To do that, he would logically need a camera. If he doesn't have one, then logically, he needs to borrow one from his neighbor. This line of logic led to pitching a scene where Homer goes next door and finds the Flanders family pulling taffy. While saying goodbye, Flanders invites all the Simpsons to a barbecue that weekend. Homer offers to bring the thickest, juiciest T-bone steaks. As soon as the door closes, Homer chuckles, "Joke's on him. I'll be dead by then." In addition to exploring things Homer would logically want to do in this situation, we discussed things he would need to do. Someone pitched a scene where Homer stops by to check in on his life insurance policy. "I'm afraid your life insurance has lapsed," the insurance agent says, peering at the policy. "Oh, sorry, it will lapse tomorrow." "Hehehe," says Homer. "How much?"
$15,000.
"Up it to $15 million. Isn't that a lot?" says the agent.
"Hey, I feel lucky," says Homer.
Another scene, pitched by Jim Brooks via Sam, had Homer going to church to seek solace from Reverend Lovejoy. Instead, Reverend Lovejoy comments on how often Homer fell asleep during his sermons.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Simpson. This is probably a little small of me, but I bet right now you're wishing you'd been a better Christian."
Some of the jokes were harsh, like Grandpa Simpson telling Homer, "I know the greatest tragedy is to outlive your children, but it doesn't feel so bad." The meanest jokes rarely make it into the script, although they often make the room laugh the hardest. Following a traditional story pattern, Homer's dilemma must get worse at the end of Act 2. "What if he's speeding home and then gets stuck in traffic?" someone pitched. I heard the word speeding and realized we could up the ante. "What if he gets pulled over by a cop and thrown in jail?" I said. That seemed overly cruel and funny. So we decided that a cell door clanging shut would end Act 2. Act 3 tumbled out as a race against time. Homer needs to get out of jail, stop at the bar to see Mo, and get home in time to be intimate with Marge. Someone pitched a post-coital snippet of dialogue.
"You know, Marge, I don't mind if you marry someone with money to take care of the kids," Homer says, "like Jackie Onassis."
"Remind me which one of our friends is a Greek tycoon," says Marge.
Bonus points if you knew Marge's maiden name is Bouvier. For the conclusion of the story, we thought Marge could fall asleep after sex while Homer sneaks downstairs to cherish every last second. He flips through TV Guide. Nothing's on. The Bible on a bookshelf catches his eye. Aware of his shortcomings, he opens it up to reveal 2 cassette tapes.
Ooh, the good book on tape. Phil Collins reads Genesis.
Bonus points if you knew Collins was the drummer in the band Genesis. Homer drifts off, and we dissolve to the next morning. Marge finds him slumped in a chair. He snores, and Marge realizes he's alive. The two celebrate. While breaking the story in the room, I scribbled down pitches as fast as I could. I always advise writers to take their own notes. Too often, this task falls to an assistant who'll capture the gist of jokes but miss the exact wording. Specific words in a specific order matter. Taking notes also allows a writer to annotate. I put a star next to a line that gets a big laugh, especially from the showrunner. Not only does it remind me to include that joke, it also gives me a window into the showrunner's sense of humor. I walked out of the Simpsons room with over 30 handwritten pages. The next step was turning the scrawled notes into a neat outline. The outline. An outline lays out the acts and scenes while clarifying and tracking the attitudes of the characters. On some series, you're not given much to work with and need to fill in a lot of plot holes. The Simpsons room generated so much material that outlining became more an exercise in choice than creation. I had 4 different possible explanations for why the Simpsons decide to try sushi. 1. Marge heard about sushi at the beauty shop or pet store. 2. Lisa is bored with meatloaf and wants to try something new. Homer defends meatloaf.
Every time I find something different. A clove of garlic, a hint of cayenne.
3. Marge says her sister likes sushi and
she's got good taste.
Marge, says Homer, that woman thinks I'm a stupid clod.
4. The family heads to Homer's favorite burger joint and discovers it's closed for health violations. The sushi place is next door.
I went with number 2 since it can